Chapter 10. Not Everyone's a Victim. When Jabari Jackson was a teenager growing up in the Mission District of San Francisco in the 1980s, he started losing friends. We went camping up in Lake Sonoma and Kermit drowned. He was the baby of the crew. We all grew up together. A year after that, Gerald got shot in the head. Then this guy Kayla got killed. A couple of other people got killed. It was like somebody was dying every month. As Jabari told me about his experience turning to drugs and alcohol, he spoke with the matter-of-fact tone of a man who had confronted his demons. "My addiction started when I was like 16," he said. "I was smoking weed and drinking. Soon he switched to crack cocaine. By his mid-30s, Jabari was using heroin. The result was," he said, "multiple times of incarceration, homelessness, crime, theft, violence, and drug abuse." Jabari said he sometimes stayed awake for many days at a time while high. He sometimes slept on the street standing up, and sometimes in cars that he stole. "It was to a point where all my money I get, I'll spend it on dope. I mean, I would sit in the house and not eat. I was just really full-blown into my addiction at that point in time. I came down with congestive heart failure, and I got hospitalized. My body was breaking down on me." While just 6% of San Francisco residents are, like Jabari, African American, 37% of the homeless are. When we look at the homeless population, we see an overrepresentation of African Americans, said Jennifer Friedenbach of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. "We see everyone who is facing oppression reflected in the homeless population. Domestic violence and child abuse contribute to homelessness. The loss of your network safety net is really what tips people into homelessness in general. People are desperately poor all the time," said Housing First advocate Jen Loving. "But what is the thing that creates the tip?" "Domestic violence," said Vicky Westbrook, who spent 2 years in prison for dealing methamphetamine to support her addiction. "We tend to have more substance abuse and more mental health issues, more trauma, and our trauma is usually sexual trauma. A lot of times we end up in prison because of toxic relationships." "A lot of the kids on the street have the same type of story," said Adam Mesnick, the San Francisco restaurant owner. "There was some sort of mental or physical abuse. There were addictive personalities and addicted parents." "It's a myth that people are on the street by choice," say advocates for the homeless. "Homeless people didn't create homelessness," said Paul Bowden, co-founder of the Coalition on Homelessness. "It was not a lifestyle choice where, in the early 80s, a bunch of us sat around and said, 'Oh, fuck this, I want to sleep in the street,'" said Kristen Marshall of the Harm Reduction Coalition. "The vast majority of people experiencing homelessness did nothing to be out here other than lose their housing, get traumatized, live with over-policing, come from generations of poverty, and not have access to jobs or stability. The U.S. government has cut welfare and housing subsidies while subsidizing middle and upper-middle-class homeowners," advocates for the homeless say. Welfare reform in 1996, which reduced the number of people receiving cash benefits from 12.3 million to 4.4 million between 1996 and 2011, resulted in a 130% increase in the number of households with children that survive on less than $2 per person per day. People dehumanize the homeless, perpetuating their victimization. "When we look at newspaper articles, when we look at how homeless people are talked about, they're often referred to as trash, they're referred to as junkies, they're referred to as basically less than human," Friedenbach said. Around the United States, cities have criminalized camping, lying, and sitting on sidewalks. One-third of America's largest 187 cities have citywide bans on camping, and half have bans on camping in particular public places. Citywide bans increased 60% between 2011 and 2014. In 2016, a startup founder in San Francisco sparked outrage after he published an open letter where he called the homeless riffraff, lamented that he shouldn't have to see the homeless on his way to work each day, and demanded San Francisco's leaders do something about it. His letter attracted attention from the international news media. In an open letter to the city's mayor, Ed Lee, wrote The Guardian, entrepreneur Justin Keller said he is outraged that wealthy workers have to see people in pain and despair. The reporter referred disparagingly to the man as a tech bro. For about 40 years, from 1930 to 1970, black families were denied loans and channeled into renting rooms, whereas white families were encouraged to buy homes. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, a federal agency, designated some neighborhoods as hazardous for lenders before the Fair Housing Act of 1968, and the segregation caused by this policy is still measurable today in many cities. And exclusionary housing policies didn't come to an end, scholars argue. They simply took the form of opposition to new homes and apartment buildings for quality of life and environmental reasons. Racism contributes to homelessness, addiction, and overdose, argue progressives. African Americans suffered 25% of overdose deaths in 2020. Half of the inmates of San Francisco's county jails are African American, and 75% suffer from substance addiction, serious mental illness, or both. My friend, who I worked with for years, who did not use drugs but was homeless, got hit by a car, said Marshall. And because he was a black man who fit some stereotype for medical providers, they sent him home with ibuprofen. What are you going to do? You're going to find something that makes you feel better. If it would have happened to me, I would have been given whatever I needed. But because he was black and used heroin, he passed away. And so instead of being regulated so you know what's in those pills to get relief from being hit by a car, you're going to say, just say no? You're going to blame him for not being in pain? But if poverty, trauma, and structural racism cause addiction, why did addiction worsen over the same period that poverty, trauma, and racism declined? Trauma from child and partner violence is at its lowest level in decades, and perhaps hundreds of years. Crimes of violence against children, including rape, assault, and robbery, declined by 1 to 2/3 between 1992 and 2010. Total reported child abuse during the same period declined 62%. And the number of children who were spanked or otherwise received physical discipline declined by 1/3 between 1975 and 2014. Few nations have achieved a higher material standard of living than the United States. Just 2% of Americans who graduate from high school live in a family with at least one full-time worker, and wait to have children until after turning 21 and marrying, in what is known as the success sequence, are in poverty. According to research by the Brookings Institution, 70% of those who follow the success sequence enjoy middle-class or higher incomes, defined as at least 300% of the poverty line. In the 50 years between 1970 and 2019, per capita income in the United States rose from $18,719 to $39,156 in 2019 dollars. True, white and Asian per capita incomes were higher at $41,374 and $44,880, respectively, compared to black and Latino incomes of $27,024 and $23,289. But per capita income still rose 84% among Hispanic people and 145% among black people. And a declining share of incomes today go to many basic necessities, allowing for far greater material wealth. In 1960, the average American family spent 24% of its income on meals at home. In 2019, it spent just 6%. U.S. government programs have proven remarkably effective at reducing poverty. By 2012, social programs had lifted 40 million Americans out of poverty, which was 15 times more than they had in 1967. Progressives point out that pre-tax inequality today is far higher, which is true. But the social safety net today is also much more effective. Government programs in 1967 reduced the would-be poverty rate by only 1.3 percentage points. By 2012, government programs, including welfare and the Earned Income Tax Credit, reduced poverty from 29% to 16%. It's true that the backlash to the overprescription of opioids has, in many cases, resulted in doctors undertreating pain, particularly of black patients. But such undertreatment also appears to have saved over 14,000 black lives, according to a New York Times estimate based on peer-reviewed research. The psychiatrist Sally Sattel notes that most patients have no trouble with opioids, with estimates of pharmaceutical opioid addiction or abuse ranging from 1 to 8% of patients. The patients most likely to abuse opioids suffer from a mental health condition, in particular depression. More careful screening, patient education, and follow-up can help. But achieving the right balance between treating pain and avoiding addiction is complex, difficult, and not reducible to simplistic claims about discrimination. One thing everyone can agree on is the need to reduce the need for opioids. And when it comes to physical suffering from accidents, we have. Although preliminary estimates show a spike in traffic fatalities in the pandemic year of 2020, the rate of fatality and injury from car accidents has still declined long-term. The latter saw a decline of 36% in the last 30 years, from 1,305 injuries per 100,000 people in 1990 to 835 per 100,000 people in 2019, the latest year for which numbers are available. It was wrong that the federal government channeled black families into rental apartments and white people into subsidized home ownership after World War II. But few argue that racism increased since then, and on many measures it declined significantly in the period that addiction worsened. The 1964 Civil Rights Act mandated desegregation by institutions that received federal money. In 1968, the Fair Housing Act closed loopholes on discriminatory lending, and governments, universities, and firms have used affirmative action programs to promote people of color to positions of power within organizations since 1965. America's social safety net has expanded dramatically over the last half century. New programs included Supplemental Security Income, SSI program, 1972, the Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, Nutrition Program, 1972, Pell Grants, 1972, the Earned Income Tax Credit, 1975, the Child Support Program, 1975, Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, 1981, Children's Health Insurance Program, 1997, Medicare Part D Subsidy for Low Income Americans, 2003, and the Affordable Care Act, 2010. The disabled have gone from being treated as subhuman a mere century ago to being treated with more dignity and generosity than many thought possible. Federal financial support for people with disabilities, both physical and mental, has grown nearly fourfold, from $40 billion in 1978 to $149 billion in 2019, adjusted for inflation. Before the passage of welfare reform in 1996, Congress and President Bill Clinton significantly expanded the Earned Income Tax Credit, which gives money directly to low-income workers and disability payments in the form of Supplemental Security Income. The Earned Income Tax Credit transferred $66 billion in 2017, which is nearly three times as much as it redistributed in 1992, in constant 2017 dollars. And in early 2021, Congress passed and President Joe Biden signed into law a $1.9 trillion pandemic relief plan that could reduce the number of Americans living in poverty by a third, raising nearly 13 million Americans out of poverty. The package expands the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, and the child and dependent care tax credit. It also provides $1,400 stimulus checks to millions of Americans, including to the homeless. This legislative package likely represents the most effective set of policies for reducing child poverty ever in one bill, especially among Black and Latinx children, said a policy expert at Georgetown University. Women have never been freer, richer, or more powerful. In 1970, just 4% of women earned more than their husbands. Today, 29% earn more than their male spouses. Today, girls match or outperform boys in education in the developed world. Spousal homicides have declined since the 1960s thanks to better policing as well as more protections for victims, such as restraining orders, shelters for victims, and automatic arrests of suspects of domestic violence. Few minority groups have achieved more progress in a shorter amount of time than the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer communities have. In 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court required states to grant same-sex couples the right to marry. Afterward, Americans' approval of rights for same-sex couples soared. Support for same-sex marriages rose from 27% to 70% in the span of 20 years. Between 1977 and 2019, Americans' belief that gay people should have equal job opportunities and the ability to adopt climbed from 56 to 93% and from 14 to 75% respectively. While people still say dehumanizing things about the homeless, doing so certainly isn't good politics, quite the opposite. Over the last decade, the governor of California and the mayors of San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle have made helping the homeless a centerpiece of their election campaigns. All have expressed great compassion and sympathy for the homeless, and all have significantly expanded the amount of money they spend on housing, shelter, and services. As for the San Francisco technology entrepreneur who supposedly dehumanized the homeless, The Guardian took his words out of context. The man did not say he was outraged that wealthy workers have to see people in pain and despair. That was simply how The Guardian reporter spun it. In fact, the man expressed, however poorly, the sadness, anger, and disgust that the vast majority of us feel when we see people suffering mental illness and severe drug addiction, living, defecating, and shooting drugs on the sidewalk. And he explicitly recognized that the homeless were in pain, struggle, and despair, and noted that we all share in the responsibility to address the problem. It is worth putting today's treatment of the homeless in historical context. California's Constitution in 1879 authorized local governments to arrest beggars, vagrants, and the poor, if they were Chinese. In 1941, California defended before the U.S. Supreme Court a law that resulted in a man being incarcerated for 6 months simply for bringing his homeless brother-in-law into the state. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected California's argument and struck the law down, saying poverty and immorality are not synonymous. Over the last 50 years, public attitudes, laws, and the courts have all grown significantly more liberal. In 1972, the Supreme Court strongly restricted the enforcement of vagrancy laws, which in some states had targeted African Americans. In 1993, a federal court ruling prevented New York City from banning panhandling because it ruled begging is a form of protected free speech. In 2006, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked Los Angeles from enforcing a 1968 law that outlawed sleeping on sidewalks. And in 2020, the Supreme Court upheld a 2018 ruling by a lower court against the city of Boise, Idaho, which found that cities cannot impose or enforce camping bans unless shelter were practically available. During the pandemic, the federal government gave cities funding to pay for hotel rooms for many homeless to stay in, free of charge for most of the pandemic. And when it received the coronavirus vaccine, San Francisco and most other cities vaccinated its homeless population early in the process. The city spends a share of its budget that is 50% larger than the share spent by New York and 6 times more than the share spent by Chicago on homelessness. San Francisco increased its spending on homelessness from $157 million to $567 million between 2011 and 2022. While it's true that people on the street suffer higher rates of eviction, trauma, and abuse than people who don't live on the street, it's also true that the vast majority of people who lose their housing, get traumatized, live with over-policing, and come from generations of poverty aren't living on the street or addicted to heroin, fentanyl, and meth. The choices that evicted, traumatized, and over-policed people make must matter. Otherwise, the number of homeless would be far higher. Late one night, while out on the town in the mid-1990s, when Jabari Jackson was in his early 20s, his girlfriend wanted to go home, but his friends wanted to drive around. "Come on, baby," she said. "Let's go home, let's go home, let's go." Jabari didn't want to. He ignored her. No, let's go," she pled. "Ah, fuck that," he said. "I'm going riding. I'm going to do this. I'll call you later." "No, come on," she begged, pulling on his arm. "Let's go home. Come on, let's go home." But she couldn't change his mind. Jabari hopped in the car with his friends and drove off to 24th and Shotwell in the Mission District. Jabari grew up middle class, not poor, in the Mission, and went to Catholic school. "I went to good schools," he said. "After grammar school, I went to Riordan, an all-boys Catholic school." Jabari rebelled. The big homies in the neighborhood was either in and out of prison, sold dope, pimping, gangbanging, and so those was the people that I idolized. Those were the guys that I saw every day. Those are the ones with the gold chains and the money and the girls and the cars, and I'm sitting out there like, I want to be like these guys right here. Jabari is, like all of us, a product of his environment. But he emphasizes, "The streets didn't choose me, I chose the streets. I was excited by gangbanging. I was excited about dope dealing. I wanted to be a part of that lifestyle. I wanted to be that guy on the corner. I wanted to be that guy with the money in my pocket. I wanted to be a part of the nightlife. I wanted to be the guy with the girls all around me with the jewelry. I want to be this person with the gold chains, the beeper, the fly clothes, the money in the pocket, all the girls standing by the cars." Jabari started dealing drugs in the open-air market around 24th Street and Hampshire Street in the Mission District. Drinking, hanging out on the block, coming home late. Around this time, I started dabbling with cocaine, snorting cocaine. Drugs were always a part of the thing because all my friends was drug dealers. We all sold dope. We all hustled on the block. Then it was just crazy after that. Boom, girlfriends, buying cars. I'm out there selling dope. Jabari was arrested the night his girlfriend urged him to go home. He jumped out of the car when he and his friends saw two men walking down the street. "We hit one of the guys, got the money, jumped back in the car, went to the gas station," Jabari said. But then Jabari and his friends did something dumb. "Instead of going home then, we decided to go back and drive around the place where we just committed this crime." Police pulled them over. Jabari and his friends fit the description. Officers found the stolen money and a gun. The district attorney's office charged Jabari with strong-armed robbery, assault, and battery. Prosecutors added a hate crime charge because the two men they had assaulted turned out to be gay. But the day Jabari was scheduled to stand trial, a woman walked into the courtroom, whispered something to Jabari's attorney, and the judge dismissed the jury. "Mr. Jackson, this is your lucky day," the judge said. "We're just going to put you on probation, credit time served. We're going to let you go." It turned out that Jabari's father's best friend was close with the district attorney. "My dad worked some kind of magic for me," said Jabari. By contrast, the other men involved in the mugging were sentenced to prison or to Walden House, a men's residential treatment facility. Jabari was arrested many times over the next two decades, but was given relatively short sentences. Finally, in April 2018, San Francisco police arrested Jabari and 11 other people for a string of 60 burglaries in the Bay Area. According to police, the thefts were being committed by serial burglars and netted 11 stolen firearms, hundreds of pieces of jewelry, U.S. and foreign currency, credit cards, and passports, altogether worth an estimated $3 million. Police arrested Jabari for possession of stolen property, vehicle theft, and stolen credit cards. Looking back now, Jabari doesn't play the victim. He says he had no one to blame but himself. "That was my punk-ass way of justifying all I did to everybody," he said. "Because deep down inside, I was a really selfish motherfucker, man. You know what I mean? I had no rhyme or reason or remorse for nobody. It was me, 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 you know what I mean? And if I messed anything up, I can beg that. Oh, I'm sorry, it's going to be okay, I'll never do it again. Just like a spoiled child." When I told Tom Wolfe that Jabari had ascribed his addiction and life of crime to being spoiled, not traumatized, he laughed. "There's similarities between him and me," said Tom. "I was kind of spoiled." I asked him why he laughed. "Because the narrative on Twitter and with addiction doctors is all about being trauma-informed," said Tom. "But it's not like everybody who got hooked on drugs did so because they experienced trauma. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of. I was at a party and I had a beer and it changed how I felt and who I am, and then it became an addiction." The criminal justice system failed Jabari not because it was too hard on him, but because it wasn't hard enough. Time and again, Jabari was arrested and either let go or given an extremely light sentence. Ultimately, what stopped Jabari was his failing health after decades of cocaine and alcohol abuse, not the criminal justice system. University of Minnesota anthropologist Teresa Gowan discovered that many homeless men reject the victim identity. Dell adamantly refused to play the victim. To do so would violate the core of his way of seeing, she notes. Ray had become uncomfortable with the idea of being classed as a victim of homelessness, she writes, and Lee fiercely rejected the victim role. He never referred to himself as homeless, for example, and in fact used homeless as a term of abuse for those unable to keep themselves together. They identified as hustlers, not victims. Dell would construct every interaction with healthcare or service agencies as an opportunity to display his hustling craft, explains Gowan. Some homeless men Gowan befriended expressed relief at not having to play the victim in front of her. "Seriously, it's cool with me, this research deal," said one of the men. "To be honest, it is a big relief to drop the bullshit. Just be real, you know. I can get kinda down out here." Some homeless express gratitude for their relative privilege. "I'm not one of these homeless people that thinks everybody owes him something," said one man who suffered from addiction, "because I still eat better and live better than probably 95% of the world's population." Others evince a discernment bordering on entitlement. "Ever since I arrived in Berkeley 3 years ago, after previously living on the streets in New Orleans, Oakland, and San Francisco," a man wrote in a letter to the editor of a Berkeley news site, "several shelters have disappointed me, particularly when I wanted to take a shower. Several of the ones I've stayed at also required you to sit through an hour of a praise God, hallelujah, soul-saving service." And many acknowledge that, for some homeless people, being homeless is indeed a choice. To say that people choose to become homeless seems indecent, noted a Harvard sociologist in the early 1990s. But the homeless are not just passive victims. They make choices like everyone else. A formerly homeless man who lived in shelters and in a tent in Seattle's Pioneer Park told me in early 2021, "For a lot of people here, being homeless is a choice," said the father of a recent high school graduate who died from fentanyl poisoning in 2020. "She was homeless on purpose. She chose to be there in Echo Park, Los Angeles." To camp out and do drugs? I asked. Yeah, he said. I guess better than living at home, and she was out there feeling her oats. It was what she chose to do. Even Paul Bowden, who was once homeless himself, grudgingly admits that the unsheltered homeless have some amount of choice. Well, if your only other option is a gospel mission, he said, fuck yeah, I'm there by choice. Until the early 1980s, many people described the homeless as bums, hobos, and vagrants, who chose their lifestyle and were undeserving of help. It was advocates who coined the phrase homeless, said the University of Pennsylvania's Dennis Culhane. They're the ones who thought homeless would be a soft, fluffy term for the public to be sympathetic to. The term was used as a way to advocate for public subsidies for housing. The anti-homelessness movement chose the term homelessness, wrote Gowan, as opposed to transient, indigent, etc., for its implication that the biggest difference between the homeless and the housed was their lack of shelter. Words are powerful. The word homeless not only makes us think of housing, it also makes us not think of mental illness, drugs, and disaffiliation. The word directs our attention to things perceived as outside of a person's control, such as the high cost of housing, and away from things perceived as in their control, such as working, parenting, and staying sober. The news media have framed homelessness as poverty since the 1980s. It hasn't been this bad since the Great Depression, claimed KQED, San Francisco's main public broadcaster, in 1983. Yet the stock market is booming. Venture capitalists are making millions of dollars overnight in Silicon Valley video games. For a few, it's the best of times. For many more, it's the worst. It was a grossly misleading statement. The poor farming families like the Okies who fled to the Bay Area in 1933 were utterly unlike the crack, heroin, and alcohol-abusing single homeless men of San Francisco in 1983. The two groups were homeless for completely different reasons and needed completely different things to improve their lives. As for unemployment, it declined dramatically from nearly 10% in 1982, the year when the national news media started to heavily cover homelessness, to just over 5% in 1989. Few were more influential than homeless advocate Mitch Snyder, who was played by the actor Martin Sheen in a 1986 made-for-TV movie. Snyder had become famous in 1982 after claiming that the number of homeless had grown to 2 to 3 million, based on little evidence and wild extrapolations. Experts at the time said that the number was wrong, but news media used it to conflate homelessness with poverty and attribute it to mass unemployment and the economic policies of Reagan. Media attention and advocacy resulted in sweeping new federal legislation. In the spring of 1986, 5 million people attempted to form a human chain from California to New York to raise $24 million for the hungry and homeless. Thanks in part to the heavy media attention, progressive advocates for the homeless were able to turn out 40,000 demonstrators to march in Washington to demand housing now in the fall of 1989. The year before, over 100 of the nation's leading editorial cartoonists and comic strip creators, including Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau, created cartoons aimed at raising awareness. In response, Congress passed the McKinney Act, which provided federal money for homeless shelters and transformed homelessness support services from the independent agencies of the 1980s into what is today referred to pejoratively as the homeless industrial complex. The number of government agencies increased tenfold, from 1,500 in the early 80s to over 15,000 a decade later. But the warning signs were all there, including with Mitch Snyder, who ran a dangerous homeless shelter. That place was an insane asylum, wrote a Washington Post reporter later, with people fighting and vomiting and urinating on themselves. After 15 years of trying to help such people, almost anyone would be depressed. Arresting and prosecuting the homeless for things like defecating in public, injecting fentanyl publicly, and living on the sidewalk is unethical, say a growing number of progressive political candidates and elected officials, because the people doing those things are victims of racism, poverty, and trauma. When he ran for office in 2018, San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin announced, "We will not prosecute cases involving quality-of-life crimes. Crimes such as public camping, offering or soliciting sex, public urination, blocking a sidewalk, etc., should not and will not be prosecuted. Enforcing the law contributes to further victimization," says Boudin. "Jails do nothing to treat the root cause of crime," read his campaign platform. In early 2020, Boudin said, "There are people who are harmed by the addiction crisis in this city, by open-air drug use and drug sales. But," he added, "those are technically victimless crimes." From 2019 to 2021, the number of crimes Boudin decided not to enforce grew. In 2020, Boudin announced that he was not going to prosecute street-level drug dealers because, in part, they are themselves victims of human trafficking. Defendants often receive plea deals and stay-away orders that are easily ignored. It's common for the defendant to return to the same corner anyway, get arrested again, and be sentenced by a judge to probation, noted a Chronicle columnist. Defendants are almost always out in the community as their cases wind their way through the courts. In May 2021, a San Francisco Superior Court judge refused to grant stay-away orders for four defendants who had been charged multiple times with drug-dealing offenses, ruling that such orders would violate the defendants' constitutional rights. The ACLU applauded the ruling, saying the judge had rejected the city's attempt to scapegoat four individuals for its own policy failures to address real needs in the Tenderloin. In 2020, a Seattle city councilor introduced legislation to order the district attorney to stop enforcing laws if they are committed by the poor, the mentally ill, or people with substance use disorders. Stalking, harassment, vehicle prowls, sexual exploitation, property destruction, hit and run, threatening someone with a gun, noted the Seattle Times, would be minimized and easily defensible. But even if we were to accept that everyone on the street has been victimized, and even if we were to agree that victimization has grown worse, does that mean we should give them the identity as victims and make them immune from the law? In 1928, a 23-year-old psychiatrist in Vienna, Austria, named Viktor Frankl, created youth counseling centers to address rising suicides among adolescents. The innovative psychotherapy he created was so effective that by 1931, not a single student in Vienna had taken his or her life. Throughout the 1930s, Frankl treated depressed patients, as well as other people with mental disabilities, and saved many of them from the Nazis who sought to exterminate them. Frankl demanded that his depressed patients find a reason for living. He would even ask them, somewhat shockingly, "Why do you not commit suicide?" He wasn't encouraging them to do it. Rather, he knew that by asking the question, they would be forced to identify and specify their purpose, which was often tied to personal relationships or some kind of work. Frankl asked challenging questions to provoke individuals to take responsibility for and gain power over their lives. Where Freud wanted people to orient toward the past, toward their childhood traumas, Frankl wanted people to orient toward their future, toward their goals. Where Freud emphasized how we are shaped by our environments, Frankl emphasized how we can control our experience. When people have a powerful reason to live, Frankl argued, and are aware of what it is and pursue it, we can be free. Frankl married his girlfriend in December 1941, 1 month before the Nazis rounded up Austrian Jews, split him from her and from his parents, and shipped them to different concentration camps. A prisoner, Frankl realized that if he were to survive, he would need to put his theory of human motivation to work. He decided to concentrate on his reasons for living, which were so he could be with his wife and parents again, as well as to write a book about how he survived the death camps. When the war ended and Frankl was released from the Nazi concentration camps, he learned that his wife and parents had all been killed. The goal of seeing them again had saved his life. Now that goal was gone, so he turned to his other goal, to write a book about his experience, and added a new one, remarrying. He wrote the book quickly and saw it published in 1946. The original title in German was Nevertheless Saying Yes to Life, and the original title in English was From Death Camp to Existentialism, which was eventually renamed Man's Search for Meaning. It became one of the most influential books of the 20th century, with translations into 24 languages and over 10 million copies sold. Frankl's books and lectures helped give rise to self-help culture, first in progressive cities and then in the rest of the United States, starting in the 1960s. Frankl loved the San Francisco Bay Area and was enormously popular here in the 1960s and 1970s, visiting several times and giving lectures to very large audiences. In 1978, a scholar in Berkeley, a fellow survivor of the concentration camps, started the Viktor Frankl Institute of Logotherapy. Progressive psychologists and psychiatrists who are familiar with Frankl's work, in my experience, revere him, as do the many progressive high school, college, and university teachers and professors who still assign his book today. However, the very same progressives who promote Frankl's philosophy as a guide for living, either directly or indirectly through Dr. Phil, Oprah, and other self-help gurus, condemn similar self-help thinking in political life as blaming the victim. Why is that?